You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
As the world around us becomes increasingly polluted, as its natural resources become increasingly depleted, as climate change continues to progress, largely unabated, scientists warn us that the world as we know it may come to an end. But no one can agree on solutions to stop this from happening, leading many of us to despair of any positive future for the human race and its planet. Our guest today on Christian Humanist Profiles suggests that we may be looking at this the wrong way, that perhaps good theology is the solution to the crisis of the environment. Norman Wirzba is professor of theology, ecology, and agrarian studies at Duke Divinity School. His book, From Nature to Creation, A Christian Vision for Understanding and Loving Our World, is the latest book in Baker's The Church and Postmodern Culture series. It's out now, and I'm delighted that it's brought him to Christian Humanist Profiles. Thanks for coming on the show, Norman.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the title of your book, I think, contains its argument in a nutshell. You recommend that we stop seeing the environment as nature and start seeing it as creation. What's the difference between those two terms, and what do we lose when we lose sight of creation?
Sure. I think that our terms are really important, and we need to be careful about how we use them, because how we describe the world says a lot about how we're going to act within it. So, for instance, if I describe the place I'm in as a gymnasium, I'm going to be expected to behave in certain sorts of ways than if I say the place I'm in is, in fact, a worship sanctuary. Then I'm going to behave differently again. Or if I'm told that the space I'm in is a store, I'm going to act very differently, right? So stores evoke shopping impulses in us. Worship spaces evoke a worshiping presence among us. And some kitchen or gymnasium would have either a cooking or an athletic kind of application that would be expected of us. And so how we describe the world as a whole has implications for how we think we should be within it. And one of my concerns about the use of the word nature, especially as it's been developed in more recent times, is that it encourages us to think that the world is basically a big storehouse of resources, right? We use the language of natural resources, which means that it's basically there for us to take and use up. And I think that's a fundamental error theologically, because theologically understood, the world is creation, which describes everything as the gift of God's love. And the way you treat a gift is going to be very different than you treat some commodity in a store.
Right. And you talk about the various historical meanings of that word nature, especially focusing on a concept of wilderness.
Right.
What's so problematic about that word?
Well, when you think that wilderness has become the dominant sort of theme within the history of American environmentalism, I think that presents problems, because wilderness, by definition, is the place that people don't belong. Wildernesses will be places that we can go visit for a short while, but it's expected that we don't stay. In fact, if we did stay, it's assumed that we would wreck the place. And so wilderness becomes an inhuman place. And it's reflected, too, when we have taken this wilderness ethic out into the world. If there have been indigenous peoples living there, one of the first requests is that the indigenous people be removed. I think that's a big mistake, because human beings belong in the world, and we're supposed to draw our life and our sustenance from the world. And we can't do that if we're operating within a wilderness ethos. And so, in my view, a better way to think about this is to see that creation refers to all the landscapes, agricultural landscapes, pristine wilderness landscapes, urban landscapes, suburban landscapes. All of them are places where people can form certain kinds of relationships. And we need to be able to use all of those different forms of landscape to help us figure out when we are living in those places poorly or well.
You know, he's not a theological thinker, I guess is what I'm trying to say, but when I was reading this section of your book, I found myself thinking a lot about Jedediah Purdy's latest book, After Nature. Have you read that?
Sure. Yeah, Jed's a friend of mine, and it's a very good book. And I think I have some questions about the way he narrates things, but it's a very good book, and it has a lot of insight that I think should provoke reflection and also some action.
I didn't think until just now that you're both at Duke, so.
Yeah, that's right. But, you know, one question that I would have for that project which in many ways I think is spot on, is that the politics that Jed is recommending for us in the context of the Anthropocene leaves open the question, and I think in some ways maybe even unanswered the question, whether or not the action that we are asked to engage in has room for the sacred dimension within the world. Because my fear is that if we just say, let's go to politics, but we don't have within our deliberation some notion of the sanctity of things, the sanctity of people, the sanctity of places, it's going to be really hard to have a vision of politics which is not simply another version of power play. And then if it's just power play, then whoever's got the most power wins. And I don't know that that's an especially helpful way to think about political process moving forward, because we know there's tremendous power and wealth that's associated with that power to make sure that we don't have the kinds of changes that both Jed and I would agree are the ones that need to be made.
Yeah, I mean, that book, I think, was supposed to give me hope, but it left me even more in despair than I was when I first read it, because I cannot share his optimism about the political process.
Right. Yeah, and I think it's a serious question. I mean, right now we have in our political process all sorts of you know, animosity, a complete lack of civility, and I think it's a feature of how our politics is motivated so much by fear, and our politics is not driven by the sense that things in the world, the people of this world, are worthy of cherishing. Politics has become the arena for self-aggrandizement or the expansion of power. And as long as that's what politics is understood to be, if that's how politics actually functions, I think we're in real trouble. And so I don't want to presume to say that if we just had a theological vision, all of our problems would go away, right? That would be naive. But I think we need to find some way in our discourses together, in our political action, to come to some agreement about how the world is not simply the playpen for human beings to do as they want. And this is something that's not just a Christian way of speaking, but I think we see it across cultures and different religious traditions that have at their core an understanding that this world and the things of this world are sacred, and therefore there's an element of human restraint that has to be at the very beginning of our deliberation and our action. And the difficulty, I think, moving forward, is to move people into a sensibility where saying the world is sacred isn't simply a pious expression, but is something deeply felt and deeply understood. And that's a different stage, and I think that, you know, it's an interesting conversation to get into. How do we move people in that direction?
Right, especially if they don't come from the same faith tradition as us.
Right, but you know, it's interesting to me that when we think about ecumenical dialogue, I mean, I've done some of this, it's very difficult sometimes to get faith traditions to come together to talk about areas of common concern, because there's so much discussion about things like sexuality, the way we think about personal identity, right? These are very, very contentious issues. But what you discover when you come to issues of, say, environmental concern, there's a lot more ability to come together, because I don't know of a religious tradition which would say, yeah, it's perfectly fine for us to do with our world what we're doing now.
You know, other than Ann Coulter.
Pardon me?
Other than Ann Coulter.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, one of the most striking parts of your argument to me was its Christocentrism.
Right.
What role do you see Jesus Christ as playing in creation, the ongoing creation?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's huge. And this was a shock to me as I started to work on this more and more, because I grew up in a home where Jesus was always described as my Savior and never as my Creator. And when you look at Scripture and when you look at how early church theologians developed Scripture into various theological positions, it was very clear that you cannot understand this world apart from Christ. And they did this in the most profound sorts of ways. I mean, we could point to several passages. Think of John's prologue, which speaks about Jesus as the eternal Word through whom all things come to be. Or to think about the first Christian hymn, which we think is in Colossians 1:15-20, which describes Jesus as the icon of the invisible God, the one through whom things are created, for whom things are created, by whom things are created, and that through him all things hold together, right? It was very clear to these early Christians when they were trying to make sense of who Jesus was, they immediately said that he's the creator. Now, this is really hard for us to grasp, because how could somebody who lived roughly 2,000 years ago be the creator? And the answer is that Jesus is the exact imprint of God, as Hebrews says, which means that if you want to know who God the Father is, you look at Jesus, because Jesus, we might say, is the interpretive key who unlocks for us the character of God's own life. And what Jesus reveals is that the life of God is the life of love. And therefore, to understand God's creativity of things, the making of things, Jesus' description and modeling, right, the ministry that he does to practically demonstrate what God's love looks like, that's the clue to what all things in this world mean. And so, not surprisingly, these early Christians, when they talked about Jesus as the Savior, they clearly understood that Jesus is not just the Savior of individual or disembodied human souls. Jesus comes to save the whole creation. And so you get this vision of a creation renewed and restored and redeemed. And that in the end, this will be a creation in which God comes to dwell forever. And it's just an amazing vision.
And this is what's so dangerous about the kind of Christian theology that's so focused on the afterlife.
Oh, it is. It's not just destructive, it's deeply heretical. Because when you read the scriptures, what you discover is not a God who is far, far away, mostly mad at us. You discover a God who's always Emmanuel, who's always coming close to creatures to be with them. Because God wants the life of God, which is to say the joy and the peace of God, to be shared with the creatures that God has made. And so throughout scripture, certainly in the Hebrew scriptures, the prophetic books speak about this repeatedly. But then in the New Testament, this becomes most intimate when we say that the fullness of God, right, not just a part of God, but the fullness of God comes to dwell in this person, Jesus Christ, right? It's this complete identification, right, the complete taking on of the fullness of human life, but then also the fullness of creaturely life. So much so that God doesn't want to see any of it destroyed. God only wants to see that the creation, which is suffering and in pain, be healed. And so it's very important, I think, just from a Christian point of view, that when Christians talk about the ascension of Jesus into heaven, it's a bodily ascension, because that communicates that heaven is not closed to material bodies. Heaven is only ever closed to sin. And what God most wants is to see that the power that moves through material creatures be the power which is God's own love. Because when that happens, God is all in all. And that's the goal of everything.
And the new heavens and new earth are a new heavens and a new earth. They're not a disconnected ethereal realm.
Right. I mean, exactly. I mean, it's a new earth because everything happening on earth happens only by the power of love. And it's a new heaven because instead of it just being God's own life, it's now life with all of creaturely reality. And so both heaven and earth become new, because what you have in this new heaven and the new earth is the full encounter between God and the creature. So it's just an amazing vision.
Yeah, the people who are solely focused on the afterlife aren't thinking big enough.
No, they're not. I mean, have a really impoverished vision of who Jesus is. I mean, it's another version of Gnosticism in which we really despise material reality, we despise bodies, and the only thing they're good for is to hold our souls until they can escape into some other realm. And that's just not biblically based. It's much more a reflection of the position of someone like Socrates than it is a position of Jesus.
Well, the big villain in your book, I think, is the broad intellectual and cultural movement called modernism. And you suggest that modernism has deeply damaged our relationship to the world of creation. How is that? How has modernism warped the way we think about the environment?
Yeah, you can't simply say that all of modernity is evil, right? That would be foolish, because
I sure like my air conditioner.
Yeah, I know. Well, it's that. I mean, you know, we like how we have, using science and technology, that we've been able to develop all sorts of things that alleviate some of the pain and suffering in this world. I don't want to go to a world before antibiotics, even though I'm aware
right.
that the use of antibiotics in agricultural context, for instance, is doing a lot of damage, right? So I don't want to say let's just wipe out the whole of modernity. That would be a mistake. But what I do see in modernity is a new kind of expression of what I call idolatry. One of the really important and signature features of modern science and technology is that it assumes a world that has no purpose other than the purpose we assign it. Right? One of the great innovations in modern science was to lop off what Aristotle called the final cause of things. Because as long as you have a final cause, that means things in this world are trying to achieve some end or goal. And as long as they're trying to achieve that, you can make sense of that goal being violated. But once you lop off the final cause, then we can do with the world whatever we want. And already at these very early stages in modern science, people like Francis Bacon, people like Giordano Bruno, we're talking about how human beings are going to assume a godlike status, and we're going to completely re-engineer the world. And it's not just that we will, you know, tinker with things. They actually sort of predicted, you might say, that human beings at one point will try to change the very structures of organisms. They didn't know about genes, obviously, but they were talking in this sort of a way. And I think what that does then is it takes the end of creation, which theologically put should have its end in God, and it puts it in us, right? Which is a monumental act of hubris, because it now says everything exists for us and we can do with it whatever we want, rather than saying, as we should, that everything belongs to God and everything exists to find its fulfillment in God. It's two radically different ways of thinking about the human place on earth, what the purpose of culture is, what an economy should be for. And again, that's not to say that human beings can't do anything to change what's going on in the world, but it is to recognize that when we come to the world with this idolatrous posture, we're going to do a lot of damage to things. We're going to violate a lot of things, rather than seeing how our creative powers can be used to further liberate creatures into the fullness of their life, as, say, like Romans 8 would suggest.
And what's interesting is most of us don't even know we're being idolatrous, because most of us can't conceive of another way of thinking,
yeah.
because this is so the fabric of the world we live in.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, we are encouraged at every turn to be idolaters. And I think one of the reasons we don't appreciate this is that when we think about idolatry, maybe we think about the story of the golden calf in Exodus, and we say, well, we're not worshiping a golden calf. Well, in fact, we are. But the real thing is that the point in that golden calf story is not that idolatry is worshiping the wrong God. Idolatry is worshiping yourself and your own ambition. Because remember, the golden calf arises not as some sort of rival God that is established by these people. This golden calf is established because of the fear and anxiety of the people. So the golden calf is simply a visible representation of all the fear and the worry that these Israelites had as they're wandering through the wilderness. And so the question for us is, you know, what are the material manifestations of our own fear and anxiety today that we then invest tremendous resources and energy in? And it's very clear that the things that have become our idols are things like the military-industrial complex, or it might be Wall Street, or, you know, on a smaller scale, it can be our jobs or whatever. All the things that we invest so much energy and resources because they think they will save us, they're often little more than a projection of the deep worries that we each have. And so the issue from a Christian point of view is to address the question, why are we so afraid? Why are we so anxious? Why can't we learn to trust in God's provision? Because that's what the Israelites were supposed to be learning when they're in the wilderness. They were supposed to figure out how everything they need, God provides, because God cares for them. And I think that's something that we have lost. And I think it's just a little bit ironic that in America, we have on our money this phrase, "In God we trust," which in fact is a flat-out lie. We put our trust in money, not in God.
Well, as you've been saying, you argue that the language we use to describe the world really determines the way we live in the world. And that's why it's so important that we stop thinking about nature and start thinking about creation. But at the same time, you argue that one of the great evils of modernism is nominalism, which is the belief that the concepts we use to describe the world have very little to do with the world itself, which is inconceivable. Before I ask the next question, I do want to go ahead and admit I am pretty much a nominalist. So I want you to understand where I'm coming from. But can you make a case against nominalism? What makes it so destructive?
Well, nominalism is not just one thing. I think we have to be aware of how one of the effects of nominalism as it developed in late medieval philosophy and modernity is the severing of God and the world, right? People like Duns Scotus, they were very intent on protecting the freedom and power of God. And to do that, they had to sort of propose an absolute abyss between God and creation. And therefore, the question of how God relates to the world becomes unthinkable from a philosophical point of view. And this is one of the effects of nominalism, because when you do that, that then frees our signification of things in the world. They don't have a divine referent any longer. They're simply a feature of what human beings say these reference will mean or what they'll signify. So that's a problem, because, first of all, the positing of this absolute abyss between God and creatures has no biblical warrant whatsoever. Right? It has no understanding of the fact that, first of all, God creates as the expression of God's own love. God doesn't have to make anything, because God's life is perfect in itself. So that God makes at all is a reflection that God is in a relationship of hospitality with creatures. God makes them, God welcomes them into God's life. And so the ontological abyss that we might say exists between God and creatures, which is important to maintain, from a scriptural point of view, is always bridged by the love of God. And that bridging takes its most intimate, practical, embodied form, of course, in the person of Jesus. So to take this nominalist position and assert that it in any way reflects a theological understanding of the character of God is to do a great disservice to the God that we worship in the scriptures. So it's a fundamental, I think, unhinging of reality from God, which then, of course, makes possible the kind of idolatrous impulses that we have seen reflected for the last several hundred years.
I agree with that. Even though I just called myself a nominalist, I'm just not sure there's a way around it. Around God's at least seeming absence from the world.
I guess the question I would ask is why do you believe that there is the absence of God in the world?
Because, as I was saying a moment ago about modernism, because this is the cultural air we breathe, I think it takes an enormous leap of imagination to be able to see God at work. And I think that leap is so much that you may as well just call it an act of will. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I get that. But here's the thing that I would say. If you go down that path and say it just takes too much imaginative power, and imagination, as you and I both agree, is not just fancy.
Right,
it's not just
making
stuff up. But if you want to take the strictly materialist reductionist point of view, then you end up with a world in which you're simply talking about mass bumping up against mass, right? Because then you're only talking about qualities that we can measure. And then you're stuck in a world in which there is no moral depth, there is no aesthetic depth, and there's certainly no theological depth. And to be sure, that's a world that a lot of people can find some attraction to, right? And Richard Dawkins, I think, is an example of the kind of reductionism that I'm talking about here. But even he, interestingly, when he starts to try to make sense of the world, he does this incredible imaginative work where he talks about genes and memes. There is no such thing as a meme that can be seen by any of the scientific tools that Dawkins would espouse as central to the scientific enterprise. Yet he has recourse to them. And I think this is instructive because it suggests to us that if we say we're not going to see God at work in the world, we're going to come up with our substitutes.
Mm-hmm.
And then the question becomes, why should we accept some of the substitutes, especially when we discover how impoverished they are? Right? I think it's instructive that in the history of Christianity, there is this vision of God revealing God's self to us through two media. The one, obviously, the written word, but the second is the book of creation. And one of the reasons I think that human beings today, in especially highly urbanized contexts, cultures where we mostly engage the world through a screen of some kind, the reason people feel the absence of God is they have no direct engagement with it. The imaginations of people have been so reduced to these very paltry kinds of images that bear very little reality. So to think about people who, say, do the work of gardening brings you into contact with powers, with surprise, with life and death struggle, with the sense of your own impotence, but also the wonder of germination and photosynthesis and fertility itself, right? Liberty Hyde Bailey, one of the great farm advocates of the last century, said, you can't be a farmer and not be a godly person, because when you work with livestock, when you work with plants, you're constantly running up against a power that in some way or other you're going to give a sacred sort of signification to.
Just don't tell that to Cain.
Why is that?
Well, Cain would be a farmer who wasn't a godly person.
Well, it doesn't mean that you will have what we might call a wholesome or edifying conception of God, or that
right. You
might not. I mean, I'm not saying that all gardeners are wonderful people. There are plenty of gardeners who I would never want to have lunch with. But the point is,
they have a sense of the sacred.
Yeah, exactly. They're, what we do with that, right? We can rebel against it for sure, or we can vent frustration because the world isn't the way we want it to be, because to garden, it's not all romantic, it's hard, and it puts you into touch with your own impatience and your own impotence, because we can't make life. All we can do is try to nurture the life that comes to us as gift. So I would say the reason so many people feel the absence of God is because they've completely separated themselves from life, or they've put themselves in practical modes of living where life comes primarily as an abstraction. And that's the problem.
Hmm. What do you do when you look out into the natural world and see nature red in tooth and claw, right? What do
sure.
you do when you see this endless struggle for dominance and
yeah.
the unbelievable cruelty and
right.
super, what am I trying to do? What am I trying to say? I don't know. The overabundance of violence in nature.
Yeah, I mean, Annie Dillard says that evolution loves death more than it loves you and me, right? That's pretty grim.
That's a great line.
Yeah, but I mean, it's very grim. But here's the thing. When we look out into the world, as you put it, look into nature, the question of what we see is important to ask, because looking and seeing are not the same thing. Looking is just sort of having a peek at something. But seeing is to interpret what you're looking at. And that means that all of our looking eventually takes us into the realm of hermeneutics, how we interpret what we see. And what I find just fascinating is that the language of nature, red in tooth and claw, about how all of creation is this unending battle in which creatures struggle for survival and an unmitigated brutality is taking place at every turn. This is a conception that Darwin came to, as he says in his autobiography, by reading Thomas Malthus. He said, I'd been looking at the world for a long time, and I did not yet have my interpretive key that unlocked the significance of what I was seeing until I read Malthus. And Malthus gave him the idea, struggle. It's all about struggle for survival, because as Malthus described in his essay on population, right, that the rate of human population growth will exceed the carrying capacity of this earth. And so those people who are now in great multitude are going to have to just duke it out. And whoever survives, that's because they're the fittest, they're the strongest. And Darwin used this sort of interpretive lens from Malthus to then make sense of what he was seeing. And it then shaped all of his description of the world. Now, that to me is a powerful interpretive lens to bring to the world. And I would be the first to say that Darwin, with his theory of natural selection and evolutionary development, gives us a powerful means for trying to explain some things. But I would be the first to also say that if we think Darwin's picture is the whole picture, that he gives us the entire hermeneutical toolkit by which to make sense of the world, that's a huge mistake. Because just a couple of things. Think about this. Native indigenous cultures around the world, they have lived in very close proximity to the natural world, if we want to call it that. And in their looking at the world, they don't see unending struggle. They don't see a bloody survival fest going on. What they see is a community of life, a community that is sometimes described as kinship. It's a community that significantly is morally charged, that this is a world of plant and animal life, even non-vegetative life, rocks, trees, streams. These realities call forth a moral response because we're in a kinship relationship with them. Now, this is a dramatically different way of looking at the natural world. It's not a naive way of looking at the world. It's not a fanciful way of looking at the world because their interpretive toolkit enabled them to survive, right? It enabled them to procure food, to build dwellings, to heal their bodies when they were sick. And so this, again, strictly by looking, they saw so differently. The question is why? So I just bring up this example as an indication that we need to be very careful when we say nature is just this place that is red in tooth and claw. That represents a hermeneutical decision that we can choose, but then we have to ask, is it an entirely adequate choice? And is it the only choice? Because interestingly, when you look at the early church, people like Maximus the Confessor argued that there is such a thing called a Christian Theoria Physicae. There's a way of looking at creatures so that we see in them the presence of the love of God. And then they talked about what are the things we need to do to come into that vision of the world. And so I would propose that rather than just succumbing to the Darwinian scenario in toto, that what we do is we look with Darwin, we look with indigenous folks, but then we also look with what early Christians developed as this Christian Theoria Physicae to see whether or not, whether or not our ways of interpreting the world are adequate.
And I see what you mean, and I wonder if maybe I'm just, I'm new on this seeing thing.
Yeah.
And maybe when I look into the world, I see this blank space and have to just trust that there's this sort of divine working
exactly.
We're talking about.
And if we're talking to people who, for the most part, don't have any knowledgeable engagement with the world, we depend on other people to interpret what we are seeing. So think about how a show or there's a network called Planet Kingdom, right, or something, or Animal Kingdom.
Animal
or
Kingdom.
Whatever. Yeah. I mean, these are television shows that just love to get these really gruesome predatory imagery, right? Video footage of critters attacking each other, right? Well, most people have very little encounter with that. But you see enough of these programs and you think, wow, it's just one bloody mess out there. But if you're actually in the world, what you discover is that cooperation, symbiosis, is equally, if not more important than competition. But we have let competition be the guiding metaphor for our interpretation of the interaction of species when in fact the much more fundamental mode of relationship is symbiosis. And this is happening at the most bacterial, microbial bacterial level, all the way up through species. And Darwin understood this because in his own work, he acknowledged that he needs to say more about cooperation, and it's not just competition. And interestingly, I think some of the work that's being done at sort of the more theoretical levels of evolutionary theory is to try to make sense of this cooperative dimension in life, and to even perhaps start talking about this cooperative dimension as entailing something like the sacrifice of animals and creatures to each other, right? And Sarah Coakley has begun to explore some of this in her own work, which I think is really richly rewarding for us when we try to make sense of the world, right? For me, it's really important that when we talk about the world outside, that we're aware of how our looking is always a hermeneutical exercise. And if we're not attuned to that, we're going to adopt a hermeneutical framework and assume that that's just the way the world is. And that's a mistake.
And that's, I think, where you really see the postmodern influence of this book.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what postmodernism has done, especially in the field of sort of how we think about nature, is they've helped us see that there is nothing natural about how we use the word nature.
Right.
Nature is an incredibly complex term throughout the history of Western culture. And when you look at its deployment, especially in the last several hundred years, what it turns out is that nature is simply a projection of what human beings or a particular group of human beings see to be normal. And normalcy is a feature of what people want, right? So nature then becomes the foil upon which the idolatries of people find their expression. So you'll find people, just one example, right? We say things like, well, it's not natural for people to do that.
But in fact, it is if they're doing it, right? Either nothing we do is natural or everything we do is natural.
Well, I mean, that's a good question, right? I mean, we used to say things like, it's not natural for a woman to be capable of philosophy because, as Aristotle taught us, women don't have rational capacity like men, and therefore they should be prevented because it's not in their nature to be philosophical, right? This language of something being natural has actually been used throughout history to legitimate orders in the world that are of advantage to the people who are establishing those orders, right? And so the term nature is just a very, very tricky term. And the reason I want us to go back to the word creation is because the referent there that gives signification to things is not simply us. It's God who gives the signification that tells us what the meaning of things are. It's not our decision about what is going to be meaningful or probable or appropriate or what have you.
I want to return to what you said about gardening. What are those of us who don't really have the option to garden do? I live in an apartment. I don't really think I could even put a box out on my balcony because the balcony has open slats and I don't want to rain down on my neighbors.
Right, sure. I mean, I think that there are a lot of creative options that are emerging more recently. So people are talking about how if you don't have space because you're in an apartment or something like that, that you come together with people and do a community project in which you can perhaps get some gardens going. Right? I've talked a lot in the past about the importance of civic organizations and faith communities that often have land that is available for them to devote this to gardening, to either growing flowers or growing fruits and vegetables, not just because you want the produce or you want the flowers, but because the experience of working in a garden is so important for enlarging the imaginations of the people so that we don't think of ourselves, A, as cut off from the world, or B, a world as alien, or C, a world that is not suitable for human flourishing, or D, a world that is the expression of this sacred power that is at work in things, bringing them into life. Right? So the gardening, it's not just about the production. It's about creating a kind of sensibility So I'm not asking that people all grow the food that will feed their whole family. That's a huge, huge task.
Right. Especially when you live in Minnesota.
Exactly. But to grow even a little bit is to come to the knowledge of your own creaturely condition. And by a creaturely condition, what I mean is something like the knowledge of your need for others, the need of your dependence upon others, the need to see how human life is a feature of being fed by lives that are countless in number, often infinitely small in their size, but still absolutely crucial for something like human flourishing.
Another great another great evil of modernity, and here modernism, I think, flows quite naturally into postmodernism, is consumerism.
Right.
What world picture do we get when we look at the world as consumers?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it brings us back to what we were saying earlier in our interview, which is that when we have become primarily consumers, and I don't mean that, you know, we've become malicious as consumers, but when we are primarily consumers, our fundamental way of relating to everything is to shop. And consumerism, it's not simply about the acquisition of things, which is problematic, or just the commodification of things, which is more problematic, I think. But it's this positioning of human beings in the world as free, imperious kings or queens who can just pluck the world at their own desire, that there is no limit to what people can have or can take. And it creates a situation, I think, in which it's not very far away that we will then treat people as commodities. And we already do that in some ways. And then you have what we get today, right? And this I think, is perhaps a newer thing in the history of humanity. Because of our technological ability, we can not just commodify the world, but we can manipulate these commodities so that they suit our exact preferences. And that means that if you don't like this, well, we change it. If we don't like how something looks, we airbrush it. And we can so quickly get exactly what we want. And that creates in us this desire to have the world on our own terms. This is a real problem. Because to be a creature is to know that the world does not exist on your own terms. And in fact, the moment we think everything in the world should sort of satisfy our particular preferences, we are not far away from having a destructive or even hateful relationship to the things of this world. I mean, imagine if my wife were to say to me at some point, and I can see why she might want to because of the way I behave at times, but imagine she said, I just don't like you anymore, and so I need to engineer you so that you will be more attractive or more pleasing or more beneficial to me. Right? I would see that as a tremendous violation of my own being. That's exactly what we're doing to the whole world.
Right into into ourselves, right?
And to ourselves, exactly.
You quote Terry Eagleton, and I think right. Eagleton is really wonderful about what postmodernism does to the self in terms of
exactly.
consumer identity.
Right, yeah. And it's a kind of identity in which you have no responsibilities. Right? If you don't like something, you walk away or you change it. And this is a world in which the freedom that is postulated is basically the freedom to be destructive.
Right.
There is no accountability. And so something like the question of human propriety or human humility or human gratitude, these being traditionally fundamental human dispositions, they're completely erased in this scenario because the world exists for me. It's not the place where God's love is at work and therefore that it exists to worship God. That's just gone. And I think what's really striking is that when you see within, say, Christian communities, these sorts of connections are not being made. Right? You don't find many Christians who are worried about how today's economy results in the commodification of the world, the commodification of life forms, the commodification of peoples. Right? Those don't seem to register as major theological concerns, when in fact I think they're absolutely fundamental.
part of the reason for that must be that the churches themselves are commodities now.
Well, they are, right. I mean, we talk about church shopping, but it also, I think, indicates how church life, but also the way churches think about their own work, has really been, you know, held captive now by this modern imagination. And it's a consumer imagination, it's a technocratic imagination, and in some ways it's even a military imagination.
Sure, yeah.
And so this imagination that we, you know, we hope would be shaped by Christ is not so. And so if you want to try to do the work of describing what does a Christian imagination for life in this world look like, you realize pretty quickly that you're going after some of the most fundamental assumptions that we will work with in our society. And that makes people really nervous.
Yeah, I mean, every time I try to think less like a consumer, I end up doing it in a profoundly consumerist way. You want to choose things. I don't know. I don't know a way around that impasse.
Well, I think one of the ways you do it, and this is, again, why I think gardening is a big deal. Gardening positions you in the world in a new sort of way so that you begin to have different sympathies, different expectations, different desires even. You know, so as an example, think about how throughout most of history, the bulk of humanity has been in the occupation of farming. To be a farmer is to wake up in the morning with a fundamentally different sensibility than today's urban or suburban consumer. Because in today's sort of urban context, when a person wakes up, their only question is, what do I want to do today? Right? That's the major question. But when you think about it from an agricultural point of view, the first thing that comes into your head when you wake up is not what do I want to do, but what do my animals need today? What do my crops need today? What does my soil need today? And so the expectations you have for your day, but also the expectations you have for what constitutes human success, human flourishing, a worthy desire, is intimately tied to your responsibilities for the life that you are to take care of. And I think there's the analogy now with a Christian community. Because with a Christian community, the people who are members of it, when they wake up in the morning, the first question isn't, what do I want today? But what does the community need? Right? And the only way you're going to know what the community needs is if you're living in relationships of responsibility with each other, right? Where you have enough proximity and regularity of contact so that when you wake up in the morning, you know that person so-and-so is struggling right now. So your thought for that day is, how can I help this person in this context of their own struggling? How can I help them? Right? That becomes the question. And then what you say, I think, in a sort of broadly theological way, is that you have a new sense of what a person is. And Paul gives this a very brief, succinct description when he says, it's no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. Right? And the life I live for God rather than for myself. And I think Christians have not yet figured out, what does that mean to say something like that in the context of today's individualistic, consumeristic culture, where when we wake up in the morning, it's not about how Christ is at work in me, directing me to the well-being of others. It's me being in charge, figuring out how I can do for myself what I most want or feel I need.
That's very interesting. The gardening is kind of an icon of a whole larger way of life.
Well, yeah, and I think it's very, very instructive that the oldest creation story, which we think is the Genesis story in chapter 2 about the Garden of Eden, that this human being who comes out of the soil, right, is basically animated dirt, is put into the garden to take care of the garden. And we shouldn't read that as a kind of punishment. Instead, we should read it as an invitation to join in God's own gardening work with the world, right? Because in this story, God is presented as a gardener. That's hugely important because it suggests that the relationships that constitute life have the character of gardening relationships, relationships that are above all infused with the sense for nurture, for protection, for weeding, for celebration, right? For delight in the beauty and the nutrition that comes out of a garden. Human beings are told to do this work, not as a punishment, but so that they will more deeply understand their own life as bound up with the lives of others. And as long as you have that, there is some hope that you will see that you are a person charged with responsibility, that who you are is not an I in separation, but who you are is always an I within community, focused on the needs of the community. Because when you have a community of people who are all looking out for the needs of each other, you have nothing to fear, because the people that surround you are looking out for your good, just as you have joined them in looking out for the good of them. And so the fear that I think is at work in so much of today's individualistic culture and its consumerism is a fear that could be met if people were to recover this richer anthropology in which we understood ourselves to be members with each other and members of this creaturely world that is provided for by God's own love.
You're making me want to go join a commune.
I mean, this it can sound romantic really quickly, right? And so I have to always say, none of this is easy. I mean, you know, even if you try to live with other people can be really difficult. Or when you try to be hospitable, right? Sometimes the people you invite into your life turn out to be really, really hard, really annoying. And so I don't want to ever suggest that the work of membership is easy. And it is. It's a lot of work. You got to have skills. You got to have knowledge. And one of the reasons gardening work is especially hard when you're just starting is you don't know what the heck you're doing. You got to learn skills if you're going to take care of plants. You got to learn skills if you're going to take care of other human beings.
Well, much of the theological background of your argument in this book reflects Eastern Orthodox thought, and in particular, you talk about these iconic modes of seeing.
Right.
What is it that makes the East so much better than the West when we're talking about seeing the world as creation?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think part of it is the influence of a theologian by the name of Maximus the Confessor. Maximus had a Christological vision that was deeply cosmic at the same time, and I think he gave us some tools by which to see how Christ gives us a whole new way of thinking about the world and a new way of inhabiting the world. So I think that's important, because Maximus looms very large in many Eastern Orthodox thinkers. And I think part of the attraction, this is also part of the danger, I think, is that much of Orthodox theology sort of doesn't go through this phase that we might call modernity or enlightenment, where we get the split between subject and object, or we get the ideal of the human being as the master and the controller of nature, or these kinds of an ethos, which really positions people in the world in a way that is, I think, antithetical to what Christian discipleship would be about. Now, saying that means that we also have to be a bit wary that Orthodox theology can sometimes be romantic, or it can be naively traditional, if you want to put it that way. And so it's important that when you read or appropriate Orthodox theologians, that you know the East-West diatribe that you often find going on there needs to be tempered, as if the West is all bad. It's not. But then you also have to use some of the things that we've learned in the West and make them go through Orthodox traditions to make them better. So I think that the Orthodox traditions are powerful. They've got rich, rich sources for us to think about and engage. But I don't want to say that Orthodoxy has all the answers, because Orthodoxy's got problems, just like Protestantism has problems, just like Catholicism has problems. And so it's about trying to forge some conversations between traditions to see how we can learn from each other.
And the very foreignness of Orthodox thought helps there, right? Because you're talking about...
Well, it does in some ways. I mean, I like to use these Orthodox theologians just because I find their modes of speaking and their modes of framing issues to be full of potential for development in all sorts of creative ways. And part of it is just my own sort of ornery nature where, you know, a lot of people that I work with, you know, they all go to Augustine. And I say, well, if you're all doing Augustine, I'll go to Maximus because it gives me a different way to talk about some things. And I think variety, just like variety in menu is good, so I think variety in theology is good.
Now, there can't be much left to say about Augustine at this point, can there?
Well, people are finding ways, so I suppose it's possible.
You come down really hard against industrial agriculture and industrial medicine, too. It's hard not to share your concern there, but at the same time, I've heard that industrial agriculture, and particularly genetically modified foods, are really important tools in the fight against world hunger. Is that just propaganda from Monsanto? Is there something to that argument?
there is a lot of propaganda there, for sure. But there's also some truth. I will say straight off, I'm not opposed to all genetic research in agriculture. In fact, one of my good friends is Wes Jackson at the Land Institute in Kansas, and he's a plant geneticist and is working on the genetic alteration of varieties of crops to perennialize them, which I think will be a huge step forward in history, because right now we've got an agricultural system which is several thousand years old, which in many of its manifestations, not all of them, but in many of its manifestations is premised upon the drawdown of fertility. That's not a winning solution for an agriculture into the future. We can't have crops and yields that we need if we're at that very moment degrading the fertility of the soil, depleting the water, that we are going to need to continue to grow into the future. So, for sure, we need to be thinking with all the tools of the science that we can as we try to deal with this massive problem about feeding a projected 11 billion people. Now, industrial agriculture represents a lot of issues that would need time to be developed. But the reason I'm so hard on industrial agriculture is because the success of industrial agriculture is premised upon the degradation of soil. It's premised on the pollution and the depletion of water, and it's premised upon the degradation of agricultural communities. It's about the ownership of the forms of plant and animal life, the patenting of those forms of life, so that a few corporations can make tremendous profits. And I think here it's very important to remember that the Green Revolution, for which Norman Borlaug got a Nobel Peace Prize, right? So I don't want to at all suggest that Norman Borlaug was somehow an evil individual. Without him, millions of people would have starved to death. So that should never be dismissed as something that doesn't deserve any kind of praise. It certainly does. But what we're seeing, the track record of the Green Revolution, is that while the yields, that the number of calories we produce has gone up, a lot of our nutritional quality has gone down. We also need to acknowledge that as all of these calories have been produced, the wealth that has been produced with these calories has not made its way to farmers. In the space of 30 years, agricultural companies and food companies have seen their profits soar, whereas farmers continue to live, for the most part, in real poverty. So we shouldn't fool ourselves into thinking that an agricultural system that is premised upon the degradation of soil, the depletion of water, that relies so much on fossil fuel-derived fertilizers and herbicides and pesticides, that further impoverishes farmers, that takes the ownership of seed and puts it into the hands of corporations. This is not a winning formula for the future. There's tremendous injustice built into this system. There's tremendous destruction and degradation built into this system. Now, what's the option? Well, I think that natural systems agriculture, organic forms of agriculture, we are now seeing that their yields can be at very similar levels as industrial or conventional ways of production. Right? There are plenty of studies that show that already. Secondly, the reason we want to go this way is that this is a system that replenishes the soil, returns carbon to the soil, returns microbial life to the soil. And we need this because the foundation for plant health and animal health, and therefore also human health, is healthy soil. Without soil, we have no agriculture. And so what we need to do is figure out how we can restore life to the soil so that we can have good yields, healthier plants, less disease, less need for herbicide, pesticides, and so forth. That being said, we still then need to think about how we do agriculture differently. We need to be thinking about how agriculture is no longer going to be the growing of commodities, which is what a lot of agricultural land does now, but instead that agricultural land will grow food. That's a huge, huge distinction to make. Because if we were to take our land and grow food, we would discover that we don't have a food shortage. In fact, we already know we don't have a food shortage. The problem is not lack of food right now. The problem is the wasting of food and the distribution of food. And then when you add to that the fact that there is so much land in our urban and suburban context that could be growing food, for somebody to say that if we don't give more money to Monsanto or Archer Daniels Midland or Cargill, that is a simple lie. And what it reflects is instead this desire on the part of consumers to have food cheap. And, of course, to do that means we're going to have the agriculture that we have, which is really destructive of fields and really degrading of animal life and really demeaning of the lives of.
I've been steering this conversation so far, but here on Christian Humanist Profiles, we like to give our guests the final word. What would you like our listeners to know that we haven't already talked about?
Well, we've covered a lot of ground, haven't we?
We sure have.
Yeah. I mean, I think what I would love for people to come away with is an appreciation for how God's love for the world is a love for all the material creatures in it. I think so many Christians are now operating with the assumption that God doesn't really love stuff, that God really doesn't love the things of this world. And as long as we have that as our fundamental assumption, it's going to be really difficult for human beings to learn to take care of the world, to learn to cherish the world, to learn to see the world as the occasion for their own delight and enjoyment. And I think this is such an impoverished view of God, and it leads to an impoverished human life as a result, because the truth is, at least as Scripture presents it, is that what God wants for creatures is abundant life. God wants life to flourish. God's love doesn't coerce creatures into a life of misery and suffering and deprivation. God's love only wants creatures to achieve the fullness of their life. And what I want people to begin to appreciate is how that's a vision that is just so compelling and so powerful, and it could lead to a changed world for us.
Well, we've been talking to Norman Wurzba about his book, From Nature to Creation, A Christian Vision for Understanding and Loving Our World. That's out now from Baker Academic. You can find a link to buy it from our website, which is christianhumanist.org. Thank you again for coming on the show, Norman.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Christian Humanist Profiles is a production of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippik. Our audio editor is Britt Stack. Thanks for listening.